Lents.
1.
The name of the planet, presuming it has already received one, is immaterial. At its most favorable opposition, it may very well be separated from the Earth by only as many miles as there are years between last Friday and the rise of the Himalayas, a million times the reader's average age. In the telescopic field of one's fancy, through the prism of one's tears, any particularities it presents should be no more striking than those of existing planets. A rosy globe marbled with dusky blotches, it is one of the countless objects diligently revolving in the infinite and gratuitous awfulness of fluid space. My planets Maria, which are not seas, and its Lacus, which are not lakes, have also, let us suppose, received names. Some less jejune, perhaps, than those of garden roses. Others more pointless than the surnames of their observers, for to take actual cases that an astronomer should have been called Lampland is as marvelous as that an entomologist should have been called Krautworm. But most of them of so antique a style as to vie in sonorous and corrupt enchantment with place names pertaining to romances of chivalry. Just as our Pinedales down here have often little to offer beyond a shoe factory on one side of the tracks, and the rusty inferno of an automobile dump on the other, so those seductive Arcadias and Icarias and Zephyrias on planetary maps may quite likely turn out to be dead deserts, lacking even the milkweed that graces our dumps. Selenographers will confirm this, but then their lenses serve them better than ours do. In the present instance, the greater the magnification, the more the mottling of the planet's surface looks as if it were seen by a submerged swimmer peering up through semi-translucent water. And if certain connected markings resemble in a shadowy way the line and hole pattern of a Chinese checkers board, let us consider them geometrical hallucinations. I not only debar a too definite planet from any role in my story, from the role every dot and full stop should play in my story, which I see as a kind of celestial chart, I also refuse to have anything to do with those technical prophecies that scientists are reported to make to reporters. Not for me is the rocket racket. Not for me are the artificial little satellites that the Earth has promised, landing starships for spaceships, spacers, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then thousands of strong castles in the air, each complete with cookhouse and keep, set up by terrestrial nations in a frenzy of competitive confusion, phony gravitation, and savagely flapping flags. Another thing I have not the slightest use for is the special equipment business, the airtight suit, the oxygen apparatus, such like contraptions. Like old Mr. Boak, of whom we shall hear in a minute, I am eminently qualified to dismiss these practical matters, which anyway are doomed to seem absurdly impractical to future spaceship men, such as old Boak's only son, since the emotions that gadgets provoke in me range from dull distrust to morbid trepidation. Only by a heroic effort can I make myself unscrew a bulb that has died an inexplicable death, and screw in another, which will light up in my face with the hideous instancy of a dragon's egg hatching in one's bare hand. Finally, I utterly spurn and reject so-called science fiction. I have looked into it, and found it as boring as the mystery story magazines. The same sort of dismally pedestrian writing with oodles of dialogue and loads of commutational humor. The clichés are, of course, disguised. Essentially, they are the same throughout all cheap reading matter, whether it spans the universe or the living room. They are like those assorted cookies that differ from one another only in shape and shade, whereby their shrewd makers ensnare the salivating consumer in a mad Pavlovian world where, at no extra cost, variations in simple visual values influence and gradually replace flavor, which thus goes the way of talent and truth. So the good guy grins, and the villain sneers, and the noble heart sports a slangy speech. Star Tsars, directors of galactic unions, are practically replicas of those peppy, red-haired executives in earthy earth jobs that illustrate with their little crinkles the human interest stories of the well-thumbed slicks in beauty parlors. Invaders of Denebola and Spica, Virgo's finest, bear names beginning with Mac. Cold scientists are usually found under steins. Some of them share with the supergalactic gals such abstract labels as Biola or Vala. Inhabitants of foreign planets, intelligent beings, humanoid or of various mythic makes, have one remarkable trait in common. Their intimate structure is never depicted. In a supreme concession to biped propriety, not only do centaurs wear loincloths, they wear them about their forelegs. This seems to complete the elimination, unless anybody wants to discuss the question of time. Here again, in order to focalize young Emery L. Boak, that more or less remote descendant of mine who is to be a member of the first interplanetary expedition, which, after all, is the one humble postulate of my tale, I gladly leave the replacement by a pretentious two or three of the honest one in our 1900 to the capable paws of Starzan and other comics and atomics. Let it be 2145 A.D. or 200 A.A., it does not matter. I have no desire to barge into vested interests of any kind. This is strictly an amateur performance, with quite casual stage properties and a minimum of scenery, and the quilled remains of a dead porcupine in the corner of the old barn. We are here among friends, the Browns and the Bensons, the Whites and the Wilsons, and when somebody goes out for a smoke, he hears the crickets and a distant farm dog, who waits between barks to listen to what we cannot hear. The summer night sky is a mess of stars. Emery Lancelot Boak, at 21, knows immeasurably more about them than I, who am 50 and terrified. 2. Lance is tall and lean, with thick tendons and greenish veins on his suntanned forearms and a scar on his brow. When doing nothing, when sitting all at ease as he sits now, leaning forward from the edge of a low armchair, his shoulders hunched up, his elbows propped on his big knees, he has a way of slowly clasping and unclasping his handsome hands, a gesture I borrow for him from one of his ancestors. An air of gravity, of uncomfortable concentration, all thought is uncomfortable, and young thought especially so, is his usual expression. At the moment, however, it is a manner of mask, concealing his furious desire to get rid of a long-drawn tension. As a rule, he does not smile often, and besides, smile is too smooth a word for the abrupt, bright contortion that now suddenly illumines his mouth and eyes as the shoulders hunch higher, the moving hands stop in a clasped position, and he lightly stamps the toe of one foot. His parents are in the room, and also a chance visitor, a fool and a boor, who is not aware of what is happening. For this is an awkward moment in a gloomy house on the eve of a fabulous departure. An hour goes by. At last, the visitor picks up his top hat from the carpet and leaves. Lance remains alone with his parents, which only serves to increase the tension. Mr. Boak I see plainly enough, but I cannot visualize Mrs. Boak with any degree of clarity, no matter how deep I sink into my difficult trance. I know that her cheerfulness, small talk, quick beat of eyelashes, is something she keeps up not so much for the sake of her son as for that of her husband and his aging heart, and old Boak realizes this only too well, and on top of his own monstrous anguish, he has to cope with her feigned levity, which disturbs him more than would an utter and unconditional collapse. I am somewhat disappointed that I cannot make out her features. All I manage to glimpse is an effect of melting light on one side of her misty hair, and in this, I suspect, I am insidiously influenced by the standard artistry of modern photography, and I feel how much easier writing must have been in former days when one's imagination was not hemmed in by innumerable visual aids, and a frontiersman looking at his first giant cactus or his first high snows was not necessarily reminded of a tire company's pictorial advertisement. In the case of Mr. Boak, I find myself operating with the features of an old professor of history, a brilliant medievalist whose white whiskers, pink pate, and black suit are famous on a certain sunny campus in the deep south, but whose sole asset in connection with this story, apart from a slight resemblance to a long-dead great-uncle of mine, is that his appearance is out of date. Now, if one is perfectly honest with oneself, there is nothing extraordinary in the tendency to give to the manners and clothes of a distant day, which happens to be placed in the future, an old-fashioned tinge, a badly pressed, badly groomed, dusty something, since the terms out of date, not of our age, and so on, are in the long run the only ones in which we are able to imagine and express a strangeness no amount of research can foresee. The future is but the obsolete in reverse. In that shabby room, in the tawny lamplight, Lance talks of some last things. He has recently brought from a desolate spot in the Andes, where he has been climbing some as yet unnamed peak, a couple of adolescent chinchillas, cinder gray, phenomenally furry, rabbit-sized rodents, his Trichomorpha, with long whiskers, round rumps, and petal-like ears. He keeps them indoors in a wire-screened pen and gives them peanuts, puffed rice, raisins to eat, and, as a special treat, a violet or an aster. He hopes they will breed in the fall. He now repeats to his mother a few emphatic instructions to keep his pets' food crisp and their pen dry, and never forget their daily dust bath, fine sand mixed with powdered chalk, in which they roll and kick most lustily. While this is being discussed, Mr. Boak lights and relights a pipe and finally puts it away. Every now and then, with a false air of benevolent absent-mindedness, the old man launches upon a series of sounds and motions that deceive nobody. He clears his throat and, with his hands behind his back, drifts toward a window, or he begins to produce a tight-lipped, tuneless humming, and, seemingly driven by that small nasal motor, he wanders out of the parlor. But no sooner has he left the stage than he throws off, with a dreadful shiver, the elaborate structure of his gentle, bumbling impersonation act. In a bedroom or bathroom, he stops as if to take, in abject solitude, a deep, spasmodic draught from some secret flask and presently staggers out again, drunk with grief. The stage has not changed when he quietly returns to it, buttoning his coat and resuming that little hum. It is now a matter of minutes. Lance inspects the pen before he goes, and leaves Chin and Chilla sitting on their haunches, each holding a flower. The only other thing that I know about these last moments is that any such talk as, "Sure you haven't forgotten the silk shirt that came from the wash?" or, "You remember where you put those new slippers?" is excluded. Whatever Lance takes with him is already collected at the mysterious and unmentionable and absolutely awful place of his zero-hour departure. He needs nothing of what we need, and he steps out of the house, empty-handed and hatless, with the casual lightness of one walking to the newsstand, or to a glorious scaffold. 3. Terrestrial space loves concealment. The most it yields to the eye is a panoramic view. The horizon closes upon the receding traveler like a trap door in slow motion. For those who remain, any town a day's journey from here is invisible, whereas you can easily see such transcendencies as, say, a lunar amphitheater and the shadow cast by its circular ridge. The conjurer who displays the firmament has rolled up his sleeves and performs in full view of the little spectators. Planets may dip out of sight, just as objects are obliterated by the blurry curve of one's own cheekbone, but they are back when the earth turns its head. The nakedness of the night is appalling. Lance has left. The fragility of his young limbs grows in direct ratio to the distance he covers. From their balcony, the old Boaks look at the infinitely perilous night sky and wildly envy the lot of fishermen's wives. If Boak's sources are accurate, the name Lancelot del Lac occurs for the first time in verse 3676 of the 12th century Roman de la Charrette. Lance, Lancelin, Lancelotic, diminutives murmured at the brimming, salty, moist stars. Young knights in their teens learning to harp, hawk, and hunt, the forest dangerous and the dolorous tower, Aldebaran, Betelgeuse, the thunder of Saracenic war cries, Marvelous deeds of arms, marvelous warriors, sparkling within the awful constellations above the boke's balcony. Sir Picard the Black Knight, and Sir Perimones the Red Knight, and Sir Pertolope the Green Knight, and Sir Persant the Indigo Knight, and that bluff old party Sir Grummor Grummersome, muttering northern oaths under his breath. The field glass is not much good. The chart is all crumpled and damp, and you do not hold the flashlight properly. This to Mrs. Boke. Draw a deep breath. Look again. Lancelot is gone. The hope of seeing him in life is about equal to the hope of seeing him in eternity. Lancelot is banished from the country of Low Grease, as we might call the Great Lakes, and now rides up in the dust of the night sky almost as far as our local universe, with the balcony and the pitch-black, optically-spotted garden, speeds toward King Arthur's harp, where Vega burns and beckons, one of the few objects that can be identified by the aid of this goddamn diagram. The sidereal haze makes the Bokes dizzy. Gray incense, insanity, infinity sickness. But they cannot tear themselves away from the nightmare of space, cannot go back to the lighted bedroom, a corner of which shows in the glass door. And presently, the planet rises, like a tiny bonfire. There to the right is the bridge of the sword leading to the other world. Donne Estrange ne retourne. Lancelot crawls over it in great pain, in ineffable anguish. Thou shalt not pass a pass that is called the Pass Perilous. But another enchanter commands, you shall. You shall even acquire a sense of humor that will tide you over the trying spots. The brave old Bokes think they can distinguish lance scaling on crampons, the verglazed rock of the sky, or silently breaking trail through the soft snows of nebulae. Boötes, somewhere between Camp 10 and 11, is a great glacier all rubble and icefall. We try to make out the serpentine route of ascent, seem to distinguish the light leanness of lance among the several roped silhouettes. Gone! Was it he or Denny, a young biologist, Lance's best friend? Waiting in the dark valley at the foot of the vertical sky, we recall, Mrs. Boke more clearly than her husband, those special names for crevasses and gothic structures of ice that Lance used to mouth with such professional gusto in his alpine boyhood. He is several light years older by now. The Seracs and the Schruns, the avalanche and its thud, French echoes and Germanic magic, hobnail-knobbing up there as they do in medieval romances. Ah, there he is again, crossing through a notch between two stars, then very slowly, attempting a traverse on a cliff face so sheer and with such delicate holds that the mere evocation of those groping fingertips and scraping boots fills one with acrophobic nausea. And through streaming tears the old Bokes see Lance now, marooned on a shelf of stone, and now climbing again, and now dreadfully safe, with his ice axe and pack, on a peak above peaks, his eager profile rimmed with light. Or is he already on his way down? I assume that no news comes from the explorers, and that the Bokes prolong their pathetic vigils. As they wait for their son to return, his every avenue of descent seems to run into the precipice of their despair. But perhaps he has swung over those high-angled wet slabs that fall away vertically into the abyss, has mastered the overhang, and is now blissfully glissading down steep celestial snows. As, however, the Boke's doorbell does not ring at the logical culmination of an imagined series of footfalls, no matter how patiently we space them as they come nearer and nearer in our mind, we have to thrust him back, and have him start his ascent all over again, and then put him even farther back, so that he is still at headquarters, where the tents are, and the open latrines, and the begging black-footed children, long after we had pictured him bending under the tulip tree to walk up the lawn to the door and the doorbell. As if tired by the many appearances he has made in his parents' minds, Lance now ploughs wearily through mud puddles, then up a hillside in the haggard landscape of a distant war, slipping and scrambling up the dead grass of the slope. There is some routine rock work ahead, and then the summit. The ridge is won. Our losses are heavy. How is one notified? By wire? By registered letter? And who is the executioner? A special messenger or the regular plodding, florid-nosed postman? Always a little high. He has troubles of his own. Sign here. Big thumb. Small cross. Weak pencil. It's dull violet wood. Return it. The illegible signature of teetering disaster. But nothing comes. A month passes. Chin and Chilla are in fine shape and seem very fond of each other, sleep together in the nest box, cuddled up in a fluffy ball. After many tries, Lance had discovered a sound with definite chinchillan appeal, produced by pursing the lips and emitting in rapid succession several soft, moist as if taking sips from a straw when most of one's drink is finished, and only its dregs are drained. But his parents cannot produce it. The pitch is wrong or something. And there is such an intolerable silence in Lance's room, with its battered books and the spotty white shelves and the old shoes, and the relatively new tennis racket in its preposterously secure press, and a penny on the closet floor. And all this begins to undergo a prismatic dissolution. But then you tighten the screw, and everything is again in focus. And presently, the Bulks return to their balcony. Has he reached his goal? And if so, does he see us? 4. The classical ex-mortal leans on his elbow from a flowered ledge to contemplate this earth, this toy, this teetotum gyrating on slow display in its model firmament, every feature so gay and clear, the painted oceans and the praying woman of the Baltic, and a still of the elegant Americas caught in their trapeze act, and Australia like a baby Africa lying on its side. There may be people among my coevals who half expect their spirits to look down from heaven with a shudder and a sigh at their native planet and see it girdled with latitudes, stayed with meridians, and marked, perhaps, with the fat black diabolically curving arrows of global wars, or, more pleasantly, spread out before their gaze like one of those picture maps of vacational Eldorados with a reservation Indian beating a drum here, a girl clad in shorts there, conical conifers climbing the cones of mountains, and anglers all over the place. Actually, I suppose, my young descendant, on his first night out, in the imagined silence of an inimaginable world, would have to view the surface features of our globe through the depth of its atmosphere. This would mean dust, scattered reflections, haze, and all kinds of optical pitfalls, so that continents, if they appeared at all through the varying clouds, would slip by in queer disguises, with inexplicable gleams of color and unrecognizable outlines. But all this is a minor point. The main problem is, will the mind of the explorer survive the shock? One tries to perceive the nature of that shock as plainly as mental safety permits. And if the mere act of imagining the matter is fraught with hideous risks, how, then, will the real pang be endured and overcome? First of all, Lance will have to deal with the atavistic moment. Myths have become so firmly entrenched in the radiant sky that common sense is apt to shirk the task of getting at the uncommon sense behind them. Immortality must have a star to stand on if it wishes to branch and blossom and support thousands of blue-plumed angel birds, all singing as sweetly as little eunuchs. Deep in the human mind, the concept of dying is synonymous with that of leaving the earth. To escape its gravity means to transcend the grave. And a man, upon finding himself on another planet, has really no way of proving to himself that he is not dead, that the naive old myth has not come true. I am not concerned with the moron, the ordinary hairless ape who takes everything in his stride. His only childhood memory is of a mule that bit him. His only consciousness of the future a vision of board and bed. What I am thinking of is the man of imagination and science, whose courage is infinite because his curiosity surpasses his courage. Nothing will keep him back. He is the ancient curieux but of a hardier build, with a ruddier heart. When it comes to exploring a celestial body, his is the satisfaction of a passionate desire to feel with his own fingers, to stroke and inspect and smile at and inhale and stroke again, with that same smile of nameless, moaning, melting pleasure, the never-before-touched matter of which the celestial object is made. Any true scientist, not, of course, the fraudulent mediocrity whose only treasure is the ignorance he hides like a bone, should be capable of experiencing that sensuous pleasure of direct and divine knowledge. He may be 20, and he may be 85, but without that tingle there is no science, and of that stuff Lance is made. Straining my fancy to the utmost, I see him surmounting the panic that the ape might not experience at all. No doubt Lance may have landed in an orange-colored dust cloud somewhere in the middle of the Tharsis Desert, if it is a desert, or near some purple pool, Phonesis or Oti, if these are lakes after all. But on the other hand, you see, as things go in such matters, something is sure to be solved at once, terribly and irrevocably, while other things come up one by one, and are puzzled out gradually. When I was a boy of 7 or 8, I used to dream a vaguely recurrent dream set in a certain environment, which I have never been able to recognize and identify in any rational manner, though I have seen many strange lands. I am inclined to make it serve now, in order to patch up a gaping hole, a raw wound in my story. There was nothing spectacular about that environment, nothing monstrous or even odd. Just a bit of non-committal stability represented by a bit of level ground and filmed over with a bit of neutral nebulosity. In other words, the indifferent back of a view, rather than its face. The nuisance of that dream was that, for some reason, I could not walk around the view to meet it on equal terms. There lurked in the mist a mass of something, mineral matter or the like, oppressively and quite meaninglessly shaped, and in the course of my dream I kept filling some kind of receptacle, translated as pale, with smaller shapes, translated as pebbles, and my nose was bleeding, but I was too impatient and excited to do anything about it. And every time I had that dream, suddenly somebody would start screaming behind me, and I awoke screaming too, thus prolonging the initial anonymous shriek, with its initial note of rising exultation, but with no meaning attached to it any more, if there had been a meaning. Speaking of Lance, I would like to submit that something on the lines of my dream. But the funny thing is that as I reread what I have set down, its background, the factual memory, vanishes, has vanished altogether by now, and I have no means of proving to myself that there is any personal experience behind its description. What I wanted to say was that perhaps Lance and his companions, when they reached their planet, felt something akin to my dream, which is no longer mine. 5. And they were back. A horseman, clappity-clap, gallops up the cobbled street to the Bokes' house, through the driving rain, and shouts out the tremendous news as he stops short at the gate, near the dripping liriodendron, while the Bokes come tearing out of the house like two histricomorphic rodents. They are back. The pilots and the astrophysicists and one of the naturalists are back. The other, Denny, is dead and has been left in heaven, the old myth scoring a curious point there. On the 6th floor of a provincial hospital, carefully hidden from newspapermen, Mr. and Mrs. Boke are told that their boy is in a little waiting room, second to the right, ready to receive them. There is something, a kind of hushed deference about the tone of this information, as if it referred to a fairy tale king. They will enter quietly. A nurse, a Mrs. Coover, will be there all the time. Oh, he's all right, they are told. Can go home next week, as a matter of fact. However, they should not stay more than a couple of minutes, and no questions, please, just chat about something or other. You know. And then say you will be coming again tomorrow or the day after tomorrow. Lance, gray-robed, crop-haired, tan, gone, changed, unchanged, changed, thin, nostrils stuffed with absorbent cotton, sits on the edge of a couch, his hands clasped, a little embarrassed. Gets up wavily, with a beaming grimace, and sits down again. Mrs. Coover, the nurse, has blue eyes and no chin. A ripe silence. Then Lance, "It was wonderful. Perfectly wonderful. I'm going back in November." Pause. "I think," says Mr. Boak, "that Chilla is with child." Quick smile, little bow of pleased acknowledgement. Then, in a narrative voice, "Je vais dire ça en français. Nous venions d'arriver." "Show them the president's letter," says Mrs. Coover. "We had just got there," Lance continues, "as Denny was still alive, and the first thing he and I saw..." In a sudden flutter, Nurse Coover interrupts, "No, Lance, no. No, madame, please. No contacts, doctor's orders, please." Warm temple, cold ear. Mr. and Mrs. Boak are ushered out. They walk swiftly, although there is no hurry, no hurry whatever, down the corridor, along its shoddy olive and ochre wall, the lower olive separated from the upper ochre by a continuous brown line leading to the venerable elevators. Going up, glimpse of a patriarch in wheelchair. Going back in November, Lancelin. Going down, the old Boaks. There are in that elevator two smiling women and the object of their bright sympathy, a girl with a baby. Besides the gray-haired, bent, sullen elevator man, who stands with his back to everybody. Easter rain. That day, a lonely old Swiss woman named Josephine, or Josefina Lvovna, as the Russian family she had once lived with for 12 years had dubbed her, bought half a dozen eggs, a black brush, and two buttons of carmine watercolor. That day the apple trees were in bloom. A cinema poster on the corner was reflected upside down on the smooth surface of a puddle, and in the morning the mountains on the far side of Lake Leman were all veiled in silky mist, like the opaque sheets of rice paper that cover etchings in expensive books. The mist promised a fair day, but the sun barely skimmed over the roofs of the skewed little stone houses, over the wet wires of a toy tram, and then dissolved once again into the haze. The day turned out to be calm, with springtime clouds, but toward evening, a weighty, icy wind wafted down from the mountains, and Josephine, on her way home, broke into such a fit of coughing that she lost her balance for a moment by the door, flushed crimson, and leaned on her tightly furled umbrella, thin as a black walking stick. It was already dark in her room. When she turned on the lamp, it illuminated her hands. Thin hands with tight, glossy skin, ecchymotic freckles and white blotches on the fingernails. Josephine laid out her purchases on the table and dropped her coat and hat on the bed. She poured some water into a glass and, putting on a black-rimmed pince-nez that made her dark gray eyes look stern beneath the thick funereal brows that grew together over the bridge of her nose, began painting the eggs. For some reason, the carmine watercolor would not stick. Perhaps she should have bought some kind of chemical paint, but she did not know how to ask for it, and was too embarrassed to explain. She thought about going to see a pharmacist she knew. While she was at it, she could get some aspirin. She felt so sluggish and her eyeballs ached with fever. She wanted to sit quietly, think quietly. Today was the Russian Holy Saturday. At one time, the peddlers on the Nevsky Prospect had sold a special kind of tongs. These tongs were very practical for fishing out the eggs from the hot dark blue or orange liquid. But there were also the wooden spoons. They would bump lightly and compactly against the thick glass of the jars from which rose the heady steam of the dye. The eggs were then dried in piles, the red with the red, the green with the green. And they used to color them another way, too, by wrapping them tightly in strips of cloth with decalcomanias tucked inside that looked like samples of wallpaper. After the boiling, when the manservant brought the huge pot back from the kitchen, what fun it was to unravel the cloth and take the speckled, marbled eggs out of the warm, damp fabric, from which rose gentle steam, a whiff of one's childhood. The old Swiss woman felt strange, remembering that, when she lived in Russia, she had been homesick and sent long, melancholy, beautifully written letters to her friends back home about how she always felt unwanted, misunderstood. Every morning after breakfast she would go for a ride in the large open landau with her charge, Helene, and next to the coachman's fat bottom, reminiscent of a gigantic blue pumpkin, was the hunched-over back of the old footman, all gold buttons and cockade. The only Russian words she knew were coachman, good, fine. Kutche, tish tish, ничего. Coachman, hush hush, so so. All mispronounced. She had left Petersburg with a dim sense of relief, just as the war was beginning. She thought that now she would delight endlessly in chatty evenings with her friends and in the coziness of her native town. But the reality turned out to be quite the opposite. Her real life, in other words, the part of life when one most keenly and deeply gets used to people and things, had passed by there, in Russia, which she had unconsciously grown to love and understand, and where God only knew what was going on now. And tomorrow was Orthodox Easter. Josephine sighed loudly, got up, and closed the window more firmly. She looked at her watch, black on its nickel chain. She would have to do something about those eggs. They were to be a gift for the Platonovs, an elderly Russian couple recently settled in Lausanne, a town both native and foreign to her, where it was hard to breathe, where the houses were stacked at random, in disorder, helter-skelter, along the steep, angular streets. She grew pensive, listening to the drone in her ears. Then she shook herself out of her torpor, poured a vial of purple ink into a tin can, and carefully lowered an egg into it. The door opened softly. Her neighbor, Mademoiselle Finard, entered, quiet as a mouse. She was a thin little woman, a former governess herself. Her short-cropped hair was all silver. She was draped in a black shawl, iridescent with glass beads. Josephine, hearing her mouse-like steps, awkwardly, with a newspaper, covered the can and the eggs that were drying on some blotting paper. "What do you want? I don't like people simply coming in like that." Mademoiselle Finard looked askance at Josephine's anxious face and said nothing, but was deeply offended, and, without a word, left the room with the same mincing steps. By now the eggs had turned a venomous violet. On an unpainted egg she decided to draw the two Easter initials, which stand for Christos Voskresia, Christ is risen, as had always been customary in Russia. The first letter, Ha, she drew well, but the second she could not quite remember, and finally, instead of a V, she drew an absurd, crooked Ya. When the ink had dried completely, she wrapped the eggs in soft toilet paper and put them in her leather handbag. But what tormenting sluggishness! She wanted to lie down in bed, drink some hot coffee, and stretch out her legs. She was feverish, and her eyelids prickled. When she went outside, the dry crackle of her cough began rising in her throat again. The streets were dark, damp, and deserted. The Platonovs lived nearby. They were seated having tea, and Platonov, bald-pated with a scanty beard, in a Russian serge shirt with buttons on the side, was stuffing yellow tobacco into cigarette papers when Josephine knocked with the knob of her umbrella and entered. "Ah, good evening, mademoiselle." She sat down next to them and tactlessly, verbosely, started discussing the imminent Russian Easter. She took the violet eggs out of her bag one by one. Platonov noticed the egg with the lilac letters, Ha, Ya, and burst out laughing. "Whatever made her stick on those Jewish initials?" His wife, a plump woman with a yellow wig and sorrowful eyes, smiled fleetingly. She started thanking Josephine with indifference, drawing out her French vowels. Josephine did not understand why they were laughing. She felt hot and sad. She began talking again, but she had the feeling that what she was saying was out of place, that she could not restrain herself. Yes, at this moment there is no Easter in Russia. Poor Russia. Oh, I remember how people used to kiss each other in the streets, and my little Helene looked like an angel that day. Oh, I often cry all night thinking of your wonderful country. The Platonovs always found these conversations unpleasant. They never discussed their lost homeland with outsiders, just as ruined rich men hide their poverty and become even haughtier and less approachable than before. Therefore, deep down, Josephine felt that they had no love at all for Russia. Usually, when she visited the Platonovs, she thought that, if she only began talking of beautiful Russia with tears in her eyes, the Platonovs would suddenly burst into sobs and begin reminiscing and recounting, and that the three of them would sit like that all night, reminiscing, crying, and squeezing each other's hands. But in reality, this never happened. Platonov would nod politely and indifferently with his beard, while his wife kept trying to find out where one could get some tea or soap as cheaply as possible. Platonov began rolling his cigarettes again. His wife placed them evenly in a cardboard box. They had both intended to take a nap until it was time to leave for the Easter vigils at the Greek church around the corner. They wanted to sit silently, to think their own thoughts, to speak only with glances and special, seemingly absent-minded smiles about their son, who had been killed in the Crimea, about Easter odds and ends, about their neighborhood church on Pokhtomskaya Street. Now this chattering, sentimental old woman with her anxious, dark gray eyes had come, full of sighs, and might well stay until they left the house themselves. Josephine fell silent, hoping avidly that she too might be asked to accompany them to church, and afterward to breakfast with them. She knew they had baked Russian Easter cakes the day before, and although she obviously could not eat any because she felt so feverish, still it would have been so pleasant, so warm, and so festive. Platonov ground his teeth and, stifling a yawn, looked furtively at his wrist, at the dial under its little screen. Josephine saw they were not going to invite her. She rose. "You need a small rest, my dear friends, but there is something I want to say to you before I leave." And moving close to Platonov, who also got up, she exclaimed in sonorous, fractured Russian, "Hath Christ's rised!" This was her last hope of eliciting a burst of hot, sweet tears, Easter kisses, an invitation to breakfast together. But Platonov only squared his shoulders and said with a subdued laugh, "See, mademoiselle, you pronounce Russian beautifully." Once outside, she broke into sobs and walked, pressing her handkerchief to her eyes, swaying slightly, tapping her silken, cane-like umbrella on the sidewalk. The sky was cavernous and troubled, the moon vague, the clouds like ruins. The angled feet of a curly-headed chaplain were reflected in a puddle near a brightly lit cinema. And when Josephine walked beneath the noisy, weeping trees beside the lake, which seemed like a wall of mist, she saw an emerald lantern glowing faintly at the edge of a small pier, and something large and white clambering onto a black boat that bobbed below. She focused through her tears. An enormous old swan puffed itself up, flapped its wings, and suddenly, clumsy as a goose, waddled heavily onto the deck. The boat rocked. Green circles welled over the black, oily water that merged into fog. Josephine pondered whether she should perhaps go to church anyway. But in Petersburg, the only church she had ever gone to was the red Catholic one at the end of Morskaya Street, and she felt ashamed now to go into an Orthodox church, where she did not know when to cross herself or how one held one's fingers, and where somebody might make a comment. She felt intermittent chills, her head filled with a confusion of rustling, of smacking trees, of black clouds, and Easter recollections, mountains of multicolored eggs, the dusky sheen of St. Isaac's. Deafened and woozy, she somehow managed to make it home and climb the stairs, banging her shoulder against the wall, and then, unsteadily, her teeth chattering, she began undressing. She felt weaker and tumbled onto her bed with a blissful, incredulous smile. A delirium, stormy and powerful as the surge of bells, took hold of her. Mountains of multicolored eggs scattered with rotund tapping sounds. The sun, Or was it a golden-horned sheep made of creamery butter, came tumbling through the window and began to grow, filling the room with torrid yellow? Meanwhile, the eggs scurried up and rolled down glossy little strips of wood, knocking against each other, their shells cracking, their whites streaked with crimson. All night she lay delirious like that, and it was only the following morning that a still offended Mademoiselle Finard came in, gasped, and ran off in panic to call a doctor. Loba pneumonia, mademoiselle. Through the waves of delirium twinkled wallpaper flowers, the old woman's silver hair, the doctor's placid eyes. It all twinkled and dissolved, and again an agitated drone of joy engulfed her soul. The fable blue sky was like a gigantic painted egg. Bells thundered, and someone came into the room who looked like Platonov, or maybe like Helene's father, and on entering he unfolded a newspaper, placed it on the table, and sat down nearby, glancing now at Josephine, now at the white pages, with a significant, modest, slightly cunning smile. Josephine knew that in this paper there was some kind of wondrous news, but try as she might, she could not decipher the Russian letters of the black headline. Her guest kept smiling and casting significant glances at her, and seemed on the very point of revealing the secret, to confirm the happiness that she foretasted. But the man slowly dissolved. Unconsciousness swept over her like a black cloud. Then came another motley of delirious dreams. The landau rolled along the quay. Helene lapped the hot, bright color from a wooden spoon. The broad Neva sparkled expansively, and Tsar Peter suddenly leapt off his bronze steed, the hooves of both its forelegs having simultaneously alighted. He approached Josephine, and with a smile on his green-tinted, stormy face, embraced her, kissed her on one cheek, then on the other. His lips were soft and warm, and when he brushed her cheek for the third time, she palpitated, moaning with bliss, spread out her arms, and suddenly fell silent. Early in the morning, on the sixth day of her illness, after a final crisis, Josephine came to her senses. A white sky shimmered brightly through the window, and perpendicular rain was rustling and rippling in the gutters. A wet branch stretched across the window pane, and at its very end a leaf kept shuddering against the patter of the rain. The leaf leaned forward and let a large drop fall from the tip of its green blade. The leaf shuddered again. And again a moist ray rolled downward, then a long, bright earring dangled and dropped. And it seemed to Josephine as if the rainy coolness were flowing through her veins. She could not take her eyes off the streaming sky, and the pulsating, enraptured rain was so pleasant. The leaves shuddered so touchingly that she wanted to laugh. The laughter filled her, though it was still soundless, coursing through her body, tickling her palate, and was on the very point of erupting. To her left, in the corner, something scrabbled and sighed. A quiver with the laughter that was mounting in her, she took her eyes off the window and turned her head. The little old woman lay face down on the floor in her black kerchief. Her short-cropped silver hair shook angrily as she fidgeted, thrusting her hand under the chest of drawers where her ball of wool had rolled. Black yarn stretched from the chest to the chair, where her knitting needles and a half-knitted stocking still lay. Seeing Mademoiselle Finard's black hair, her squirming legs, her button boots, Josephine broke out in peals of laughter, shaking as she gasped and cooed beneath her down comforter, feeling that she was resurrected, that she had returned from faraway mists of happiness, wonder, and Easter splendor.